colleagues and friends. Welcome again to the public lecture by Professor Roger Watson. And welcome to this International Visiting Research Fellow public lecture and organized by the School of Nursing and Midwifery from University of Newcastle. And before we proceed, I would like to acknowledge and respect the Papillon land of the Arapaho people, traditional custodian of the land on which this campus of the University of Newcastle is situated, and pay my respect to the elders both past and present. So welcome again. This lecture is organized in celebration of our school's 25th anniversary, as well as our university 50th anniversary. So this year is a very special year for us, and I'm also very happy to see that we have guests from Hong Kong, from mainland China, joining this lecture, and also on this coming Friday, join our 25th anniversary. So thank you again for coming. And some of you probably have heard me introduce Professor Roger Watson a few times. Yeah? But you need to bear with me. Yeah, I need to introduce him again for this lecture. And as you all know that Professor Roger Watson is the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing and also Editor of Nursing Open. So Professor Roger Watson is a graduate of the University of Edinburgh, and he got a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Sheffield. And he also qualified in nursing at St. George's Hospital, London. And Professor Watson belonged to a number of learned societies, so just to name a few. So he is the Fellow of the American Academy of Nursing, Fellow of the European Academy of Nursing Science, Fellow of the Royal College of Nursing, Fellow of the Faculty of Nursing and Midwifery of the Royal College of Surgeons, and most importantly, he is also the Fellow of the Royal Society of Biology and also the Fellow of the Royal Physicians of Edinburgh, which you know that the latter two societies are not nursing societies. So it is really very prestigious to be able to be a Fellow of these learned societies. So Professor Watson's research focus is in the care of older people, and he has a special interest in the feeding and nutritional problem of older people with dementia. So Professor Watson is a frequent visitor to the Far East, Southeast Asia, and Australia, and he has an honorary appointment and visiting position in China, Hong Kong, and Australia. And Professor Watson has been on the review panel of a number of national grants committee, and last year, 2014, he was a member of the UK Research Excellency Framework subpanel for allied health professions, dentistry, nursing, and pharmacy. So today, his lecture will focus on the application of Bokken scaling to clinical practice. And I'm sure you will learn a lot from Professor Roger Watson. So please join me to give him a warm welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, hi. Hello, very nice of you all to come. I can tell that this lecture theatre uses lecture capture.
Yeah.
You get lines on the, on the PowerPoint, you can always tell. Yeah. So I'm capturing it on that, but you may have it captured elsewhere too. Thanks very much for coming. I feel like I've got a fan base following me because I see various people that I know from the other sessions. And it gives me a huge amount of pleasure to be able to inflict this upon you today, because this is one of my interests, Bokken scaling, which is, I'll tell you what it is in a minute. And I hope I can, we've an hour allocated, I won't speak for a whole hour, hopefully you can ask me some questions later. And I will get on to some clinical applications at the end, I think that's what Sally was keen to do. But I do have to explain what Bokken scaling is, because I think if I asked people what it was, I don't think a great many hands would shoot up. So I will give a non-technical explanation, which is all I'm capable of doing, really. And Sally's had some of this before, but it's an unusual technique. What else can I say about Bokken scaling? I've been using it for the last 20-odd years in one way or another, and it's a technique which in the last 5 to 10 years has really grown. Lots of, you know, there's over 1,000 papers out there using Mockin scaling, and the actual application of the method is getting much more sophisticated. So it's a very, I think it's a very useful method. I hope I can sell it to you, at least in part. And I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised to meet one of your colleagues, Sally, whose master's student had used Mockin scaling in the project here. And, you know, probably the only person in the whole of Australia ever to use it. Right. So, the purpose of basically it's a multivariate statistical method. And the purpose of measuring things in social research, as opposed to doing qualitative research, is to investigate, latent variables and groups of variables. In other words, when we try to measure something in social sciences like depression, happiness, nursing care, whatever, we can't take these things and put them on a table and measure them with a ruler or weigh them. We've got to measure them through proxy measures by asking questions about them. And we're familiar with this. We're familiar with asking questions and Likert scales and things like that. It's just ways of tapping into latent variables. And there are a range of methods that can be used. Classical test theory. I'll define what I mean by classical test theory in a minute. Latent class analysis. I'm not going to talk about that at all, but cluster analysis falls under that. And item response theory, which is where Mockin scaling falls. So I'll spend a little bit of time distinguishing item response theory from other kinds of measurement theory. And first of all, so I won't deal with latent class analysis, that's cluster analysis, but it lies somewhere between the two methods. But classical test theory, which a lot of you will be familiar with it, looks at things like internal consistency, Cronbach's alpha, those sort of measures, and also factor analysis falls within classical test theory. And until I became involved with item response theory, I didn't realise that factor analysis fell within classical test theory, but it does. And I'm not here to promote Mockin scaling or item response theory over classical test theories, because I use both. I use exploratory factor analysis, principal components analysis, and also confirmatory factor analysis and item response theory. They've got different uses, they've got different applications, and not everything works under classical test theory. Some questionnaires don't come out looking at all useful after applying factor analysis. And some questionnaires don't come out looking at all useful. When you use Mockin scaling, they don't work for everything. They have their uses. But item response theory does have some advantages over classical test theory, which I'll try to explain. So some of the problems with classical test theory, I'm not going to demonstrate this in a huge amount of detail, but one of the problems with it is that any combination of items on our questionnaire can give a score. So for example, if you've got five items on a questionnaire and they're scored 1 or 0, the maximum score is 5, the minimum score is 0, but a score of 3 could be a score on any of those items. A score of 2 could be a score on any of those items. You don't know which items have been scored. So that's one problem with factor analysis and classical test theory. It doesn't give you any information about which items have actually been scored, and that's quite different from item response theory because of the way it works. So you don't know what a score means, essentially. If you've got a series of, I always use depression as the example because it's easy to envisage, but if you've got a series of items from I don't want to get out of bed today up to I feel like jumping in front of the train, killing yourself or whatever. You don't know if a score of 1 means that the person wants to kill themselves or if they just don't feel like getting out of bed. So it doesn't give you much information about how severe the actual condition is, unless they score 5, in which case you know they've scored on everything. So that's classical test theory. As I say, I'm not saying that it is not useful, I'm just saying that it has its limitations. Item response theory, on the other hand, and there are several methods falling under item response theory, and some of these, I'm sure some of you in the room will have heard of RASH scaling, RASH analysis. That's a form of item response theory. It's a parametric form as opposed to Mockham scaling, which is non-parametric. And again, I'll explain what I mean by that in a few minutes. And partial credit models and Mockham scaling, which falls within item response theory. And I see people writing things down, which is very nice, but you're welcome to have these slides after the session. I'll send an updated version to Sally. You can email me for them if you want. My email's at the end. They're also on my slide share under LinkedIn, which is easy to find. So the advantages of item response theory are that only a specific set of items on a questionnaire produces a given score, so you know what the score actually means. So that's it. That's the simple difference between the two. Of course, there's lots of mathematics and such like behind that I'm not going to go into because I'm not capable of doing it. I'm a consumer of Mockham scaling. I'm not somebody who develops it or understands all the mathematics behind it. But that's the essential difference. Classical test theory gives you a score. You don't know really what it means unless it's the maximum score or the minimum score. Item response theory helps you to understand scores in between the maximum and the minimum. So what I'm going to do is spend maybe 5 or so minutes trying to tease that out and try and exemplify what I mean here's a questionnaire. It's called the What a Nurse Must Do questionnaire. Okay, it's got a series of items on it. A nurse must turn up for work on time, and a nurse must be accountable for his or her actions and such like. Okay. And you've got a series of mean scores and standard deviations. And that's how the questions are written in the questionnaire. It's an imaginary questionnaire. That's how the questions are written in the questionnaire. If you give it to a series of people and they can answer from never up to always, 1 to 7 on a Likert type scale, that's a sort of pattern of scores that you might get. I just want to say, just be sure, this questionnaire doesn't exist, okay, so don't go and ask me for a copy of it. What I've done here is I've taken real data and imposed some other questions on them, because the data are anonymous, they're supposed to be anonymous, I didn't want to use the actual data. So I've actually sort of made it up using items out of my own head in a way. So there are a couple of things you can do with series of items scored like that. And for those of you, certainly for the students in the room, who are and for colleagues too, who are writing up papers for journals, we're way beyond presenting a list of items with their mean values and trying to talk about them. Okay, we need ways of aggregating these. Don't ever present that in a journal because nobody's interested in it. You've got to do something with it in order to see if there's something lying behind those responses. In other words, is there a latent trait? And one of the things you can do is to factor analyze it. That's using classical test theory, and that's what that would look like there. Again, it doesn't exist, this questionnaire. I've made it up, but I've tried to be clever. And factor analysis groups sets of similar items together. So these are professional items, and these here would be more sort of things that the nurse does. So that's one thing that you can do with it. And the factor analysis there is real, but the items on the labels on the questionnaire are not real. So that's one thing that you can do, but it only tells you that there are a couple of domains or dimensions in the questionnaire. If you go and score those domains or take a total score from the questionnaire, you don't get very much information about which items are contributing towards the score. The other thing that you can do with those, I'll flip back a minute. Those items are not ordered in any way. Those are just the order of items in the questionnaire. Those are ordered by the way that the variance comes out in the questionnaire by factor analysis. But another thing that we can do is to order items by their mean value. Very easy thing to do. I've done it by ascending means here. And you can do this on SPSS or any statistical package just by pressing a button. And that gives you a little bit more information. It's a very simple thing to do. And it had always intrigued me before I came across item response theory. Can we actually make something out of the order of the items? And you can actually see that there is a sort of interesting order of items there. The most, you know, nurses must turn up for work on time is a very popular, highly scored item. Nurses need to write lots of notes is not so important there. There is a kind of order there that makes a little bit of sense. I found it hard to make up items that suited both these analyses. But the point is that you can order any set of items by their mean value. What you want to know is, do they always come out that way? Are there a set of items within that that you can actually use to measure something meaningful? Because the mean order of items may not always be the same. It may be random. So are there methods we can use to look at the order of the items and pick which items are always ordered that way and then find out that it's useful? So that's the sort of step from classical test theory to item response theory. So that's the method in a nutshell. What I want to do is explain sort of the nature of a Mockham scale. And a Mockham scale is described as being hierarchical and cumulative. It's hierarchical because the items are ordered in a certain way, and it's cumulative because if a person scores at one level in the trait, they will score at all the levels below it, but not necessarily at the one above it. And so that's a difficult, if you haven't come across that concept before, it's quite difficult to grasp. But I will demonstrate what I mean. And I'm not going to go into a huge amount of history here, but it all began with this man here called Louis Gutmann, who developed the concept of a Gutmann scale. And I think to understand a Mockham scale, I think it's useful and in fact necessary to understand what a Gutmann scale is and what the concept of a cumulative scale is. And the concept of a cumulative scale is that items are ordered reproducibly, not just by their mean values, but what I mean is that every time you run that scale, the items should come out in the same way, or some of them should. Some items won't, but they get dropped from the scale. Items are ordered in a meaningful way. So in other words, and again I'll try and demonstrate that in a minute, but any set of items can be ordered by their mean values, and sometimes you can get a Mockham scale, it's a consistent set of items, and they don't actually mean anything. That's not a Mockham scale, it's just a set of items that happen to scale. A score on an item indicates the extent to which the trait is present. So if you've got an item that's scored from 1 to 7, it's scored 7 if there's more of the latent trait present. You know, that's an obvious thing to say, but if an item on a depression scale is scored high, it means that there's more depression present in that person. And also the score on the whole of a questionnaire measuring something orders the latent trait. Again, these are very obvious statements, but they're things that you need to be clear on, that if somebody scores 10 as opposed to 7 on a scale of measuring depression, 10 means they're more depressed than 7. It's obvious, but these things need to hold in order for that to be true of a Mockham scale. Or a Gutmann scale, much the same thing. And this is a good example of a Gutmann scale. I use this example a lot. I think Sally's seen this one before. This is a car wash menu. I guess you've got them in Australia and elsewhere. And this is essentially a cumulative scale. The price that you pay along the top, that's in British money, represents the score, and these are the number of items on the questionnaire. So essentially, the more items that you want done, from tyre dressing up to soft brush, wash and dry, the more it costs you. Okay? So if you want all of these things, it's going to cost you £7. If you just want that there, it's only going to cost you £1.99. And the order is always the same, because obviously these things have been priced. So that's an example, a very simple, everyday example of not necessarily a Gutmann scale, but a cumulative scale. Very obvious commercial point. The more you want, the more you pay. So here's an example of a cumulative scale or an implicational scale whereby the score actually means something. So I'm Scottish, so I always use this example. I've got 5 items here, and they're ordered in a particular way. And if this is a true cumulative scale, they'll always come out in this order. And I hope that by looking at the questions, you realise what the order and what the meaning is. The first item is, I wouldn't object to sitting next to a Scottish person on a bus, okay? You can make it Chinese, Australian, anything, New Zealand, anything you like, but in my case, I'll self-deprecate and make it Scottish. Most people would say, it's okay, I wouldn't mind sitting next to a Scottish person on the bus, they're not such bad people, I met one once. Second question, I wouldn't object to having a Scottish family living next door to me. Now, Somebody might say, well, I don't mind sitting next to the person on a bus, but I'm not having them living next door to me. I don't like them that much, you know. We make it more, go up another notch. I would have no objections to having a Scottish person dine in my house, you know. So somebody may well want to sit next to me on a bus. They might tolerate me living next door, but they might not want me to come into their house and sit with them. And at a party, I wouldn't hesitate to dance with a Scottish person. You know, you may say yes to all the other things, but say I'm drawing the line at dancing with a Scottish person. And finally, I wouldn't have any objections to my son or daughter marrying a Scottish person. I think you can see that the level of what's called difficulty in that scale increases towards the top. And the idea behind the scale is that if somebody says that they would have no objections to their son or daughter marrying me or a Scottish person, they would say yes to all of the other items. But if they said, if you knew that they said yes to item three, I would have no objections to having a Scottish person dine in my house, you know that they've said yes to items one and two, but you don't actually know if they've said yes to items one and four. So if this scale holds, if it's a true cumulative scale, somebody who scores one has scored on that item, somebody who scored four has scored on all those items there, and that holds almost every time you run the questionnaire. That's the point behind what we call a cumulative scale. So that's a fairly straightforward example, but it's easier to think about than some of the clinical examples. And now, we're on to the technical stuff now, but we'll get through it quickly, okay? So the idea, that Gutman's idea was that people responded to items every time in the same way, not only in a certain order, but that when somebody met that part of the latent trait, they either scored nothing on it or one on it. So they scored there or there. There was no graduation in between, and that the items were ordered along the latent trait in that way. Problem is, though, that don't worry about that. Items on questionnaires actually don't behave like that. They probably behave like that for individuals, whereby you either score or you don't, but if you measure it in a group of people, it doesn't work that way. What you get is what's called a stochastic relationship, a probabilistic relationship between the score on the latent trait and the probability of scoring on the item. And the other way of looking at that is, here's the person's score on the latent trait, and that's the person's score on an item. And what I mean here is that if this is measuring depression, the more the person's depressed, the more likely they are to score high on that questionnaire, on the item, sorry. So what you do with item response theory, as opposed to factor analysis or classical test theory, you can actually look at the individual items, how they behave on their own and relative to other ones. That's another unique feature about it. So, again, you can also order items. And if this is the latent trait, if that's very depressed and that's not depressed and that's the probability of scoring it, item 2 is more difficult than item 1. In other words, item 2 represents more of the latent trait than item 1. It's more unusual to score on. So item 2 in my example, that would be marrying a Scotsman, that would be sitting on the bus with them, you know. It's further along the trait. And it represents more of the latent variable being present. You don't know that with factor analysis, you don't know which items are contributing, but you do with item response theory. So then along came Robert Mochen, still alive, and Robert Mochen developed Mochen scaling, it's named after him. And Robert Mochen's idea was that Mochen scaling adhered to all the assumptions of item response theory, which I'll run through very quickly, because Mochen scaling developed at the same time as other methods of item response theory. It was a stochastic version of Gutman scaling, in other words, it used probability to relate the score on the trait to the score on the item, and you could produce hierarchical cumulative scales just in the same way as a Gutman scale. And the assumptions of item response theory are, here are some words that you may or may not have come across already. I won't be asking you questions about them, don't worry. But one, that the scales are unidimensional. A scale that's produced by item response theory measures one thing. That's the idea. That's a sort of given for any questionnaire. Even with classical test theory, when you get a factor that's said to be unidimensional, it's measuring one thing. So it's measuring depression, or one aspect of depression, and not something else. Local stochastic independence, which is a horrible expression, and I'm quite sure that nobody's come across this before. It's a difficult thing to explain, but what it means is that the score on one item doesn't influence the score on another, despite the fact that these items are measuring the same latent trait. So the score on an item like "I don't feel like getting out of bed" is not influenced by the score on the item "I want to end my life," and vice versa. The fact that they score together is because of the latent trait. It's an assumption that we make. We assume that the items are monotone, in other words, that the more of the latent trait that's present this way, the more of the score on the item. It doesn't go up and come down again, and we can look for that. If the item goes up at the beginning of the latent trait and comes down towards the end, then it's no use. It can't be used to measure, and some items do that. They've got to be eliminated. And we assume, well, say double monotonicity or invariant item ordering, it's the same thing. What we assume is that the items, if you've got three items and they're ordered there, there, and there on the latent trait, that's the same for the whole group and for every single individual in the group. That's another assumption, and you can test that assumption. None of these things apply to classical test theory. It doesn't matter what the items do, whether they intersect, whether they come out in a different order, whether they go up or down, it doesn't matter. But in item response theory, we want very pure items that don't cross over with each other, they always end up in the same place, and they don't dip at the end of the trait. So just accept that those are the things, those are the assumptions. Now, and I'm going to get on. The slide after this is onto a clinical example. This is the last of the sort of technical slides before I bring up some other issues at the end about the method. So the criteria for a valid Mockin scale, you don't have to remember this. What I'm just trying to get across here is that within the method, there are criteria that you can use to judge whether a Mockin scale is there or not. First of these is scalability. You can measure how often items don't scale, so you can get a measure of how strong the scale is. There are criteria for that. You can measure the reliability. It's a little bit like Cronbach's alpha. It's a single test, reliability test, but a single time reliability test. You can test for that. It's not quite the same as Cronbach's alpha, but you can test for it. In other words, what you're testing for is the extent to which all the items are measuring the same thing at the same time. You can measure the probability of getting a Mockin scale, because you can imagine it'd be quite easy at random to pick Mockin scales, but you can actually work out how likely you are to get them. That's an important criterion as well. And you can measure for low violations of that in the item, dipping in the item, and you can measure for the extent to which the order of items is the same in the whole group and in every individual. So there are criteria for doing this. Don't worry about the actual values, but you can describe a scale as being either weak, moderate, or strong, or below weak, you don't have a scale. So there are specific statistical criteria that you can run on statistical packages, which I'll come to, which actually show you if the Mockin scale is, you know, strong, valid, reliable. Right, here's a real clinical example which I'm going to use to show you how a Mockin scale looks in terms of scoring across a range of a trait. My interest has been for the last 25 years, or since clinical practice in fact, has been in feeding difficulty in dementia. And this is the EDFED scale, the Edinburgh Feeding Evaluation and Dementia Scale, 10 items. And I've written the items here in a certain way, as you see. I don't want to bother you with all the scores and all the different the details of the questionnaire, but essentially you measure always, never, sometimes, or often, 0, 1, or 2 for each of the items, and you add up the scores on the items. Now, if you take the EDFED scale on a large sample of people and factor analyse it, what you get is a couple of items coming out which are nursing actions, a couple of items coming out which are to do with nursing observations, and then these 6 items here come out together as one factor. So classical test theory sets them aside as a specific unidimension within the scale, and by luck probably more than design, they also form a Mockham scale. This doesn't always happen. Sometimes factor analysis and Mockham scaling give you different scales within questionnaires. They look at unidimensionality differently. In this case, we got exactly the same scale. So, if you imagine the scale written like this, it's written in a particular way, and you'll see why. I've ordered the items in the way that they're scored. If we, as I've already said, if we used factor analysis and we didn't do any other analysis, we wouldn't know what a score on the scale meant. But in the case of a cumulative scale, we do. So keep your eye on that score there. So the items score in this particular way. The most easy, the most easy item to score on is refusing to eat. Obviously, patients tend to refuse to eat, and that's something that patients will do at the beginning of their feeding difficulty. At the end of the scale, just leaving their mouth open and letting food fall out is the most difficult item. So they're ordered in terms of the difficulty by their mean score. So if somebody scores sometimes on refusal to eat, they score 1. If they score often, they score 2. This is how the scale works. If what happens then is the next item begins to score, and they score 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on, okay? Quite obvious. Up to a maximum score of 12. So we'd know under classical test theory what a score of 0 meant, would mean they've got no difficulty. We'd know what a score of 12 meant, we'd know the score on all the items. But with Mockham scaling, we know, for example, a score of 8 means they're scoring on these items and not necessarily on these here. It doesn't work for absolutely everybody, it's for the majority of the people who are scoring on it. I haven't shown every potential combination of scores there, by the way, because it's a bit more complicated than that. But you get the idea that the scoring is cumulative, like that. Okay? Right, excuse me a second. That's probably the most difficult part over, okay? I'll come back to some very concrete clinical examples in just a minute. I mentioned that you can run Mockham scaling on statistical packages, and just in case anybody's interested and wants to do this, there used to be, you can't run it on SPSS, unfortunately. There is a student in Holland working on making a bolt onto SPSS for it, but I haven't seen any evidence of that yet. There used to be a Windows package, but that no longer runs on Windows 8 and 10. So what you have to do, there are one or two other packages that run Mockham scaling, but in a very crude form. But basically, it's run on the computing project R. I don't know how many people have heard of R. It's online, public domain, free software, which is a nightmare to use, because it was run by Syntax. So don't go, whoopee, we found something free, because it really is an absolute nightmare to use. But I depend heavily on my colleagues in Holland who develop Mockham scaling and also develop the R package. There's a package there, a recent version of the package. The package changes every year because they keep updating things that you can do. And I get the Syntax from them, I keep it on a blog, and I keep it on a Word document, and I just paste it into R. Run it that way, so it's actually quite easy once you get the hang of it. But R is quite difficult to use, but it's worth getting. You know, you can do anything on R as long as you've got the syntax, and I'm sure there must be statisticians around the university who use it. It's available in every country in the world, and it's completely, as I say, completely free. So one of the things that you can do on R is that you can, just to show you some examples of the things that you can do, you can actually look at the individual items. These happen to be items, that's item 5 from the EdFed scale, in a recent different sample from the one that I showed you before. It doesn't work exactly the same in each group. And what you notice here, you can run the item, you can actually plot it out, and you can see that it's not monotonic, okay? As this is the latent trait, that's the score on the item. As the score goes up, for some reason, the score comes down at the end. So in this particular group, for some reason, it's a group of older people in the north of Italy in nursing homes. For some reason, that item doesn't work very well. So you can pick this out graphically. You don't have to do any statistics to do this. You just plot them, you can see it. If you do the statistics, it's absolutely perfect. It shows that this item is not monotone. So you can do things either way on R. The other thing you can do is you can plot item pairs to see if they intersect or if they don't intersect. And here's a couple of items, spillage and leaving food in the mouth. And as you, if you remember the initial list of questions from the EdFed scale, spillage was a different factor, a different part of the scale from the one that was behavioural, leaving food in the mouth. And indeed, it shows here that they're not part of the same scale. They're not good mocking items because they intersect. So they're no good as a pair of items. You've got to drop one of those items. And you can also look for items that behave well in terms of mock and scaling. And these behave perfectly because refusing to open the mouth and refusing to swallow sit nice and far apart. They're both monotone. I know it flattens out a bit. It's not perfect, but those are good items. So you can actually plot it and actually see the items. So even if you don't understand the mathematics or how to read the output on R, doing mock and scaling, you can actually inspect the items this way. So it's actually very useful. And at this level, as long as you know what you're doing, quite easy to use. Now, I'm just going to move away slightly from mock and scaling just for a second. What you can also do is you can run other item response theory tests on the items, just the same as you can with RASH or any other type of item response theory. So just because it's mock and scaling and because it's non-parametric, then it doesn't mean to say you can't look at the items in a little bit more detail. So for example, you can plot what are called the response options. And this is item one on the EdFed scale, which is not one of the behavioural ones, but it's a very easy item. And what you see is that you've got three options on the questionnaire, 0, 1 and 2. And if an item behaves properly, I'll have to turn round, what you get is the 0 score comes down as the 1 score goes up and then tails off and the 2 score goes up. Okay, so the three options should look like that. Sometimes they don't, so you can inspect that. If they don't look like that, then there's something wrong with your items. And items, for various reasons, behave differently. If that item wasn't monotone, it wouldn't behave like that. So you can actually look at the actual item options. And this is quite common in item response theory that people do this. But I think, as far as I'm aware, this is only the second time that somebody's actually used these methods to look at mock-and-scaled items. It's been used once before, but we've extended it just slightly. And that's a very easy item. What you would imagine if you had a more difficult item, one at the end of the scale, what you would imagine is it would score further up the scale. It would only respond at higher levels of the total score. And indeed, that's item 10, which is a much more difficult item. And again, you don't get the same pattern, but as predicted, you can't quantify these things, it's purely visual. You can say that it's going to score further up. So the 0 score comes down as the middle score goes up and fades away, and the high score goes up towards the end. So it's just a good way of checking that the items on an item response theory scale behave properly. So you can apply these methods to mock and scales as well as you can to any other type of scale. And the other thing that you can do, this is the EdFed scale, on a smaller sample of elderly nursing home care residents in Italy, is that you can test what's called the information function on the questionnaire. Now, the information function is a measure of how much information each item in the questionnaire is contributing at the different levels of the latent trait. And ideally, if you've got a really good questionnaire, your line should be right along the top. It should be a straight line. Every item should be contributing to the information in the questionnaire all the way through the latent trait. Unfortunately, you can see that at the low levels, there's quite a good contribution, and at the high level on the total score, but in the middle of the total score range, there's a dip. So that tells you that the questionnaire needs more development. You need to develop more items in the middle range of the scale. So again, just to demonstrate, these are things that are common in parametric item response theory. In non-parametric item response theory, you can do them as well. So again, the EdFed scale is pretty well developed and pretty well used and validated, but you can see from these analyses that it needs a little bit more work. And again, this is the first time these techniques have been combined with mock and scaling techniques. So finally, for the next few minutes, a few clinical examples, and one of these is I had to change the slides because one of these is hot off the press, and I'll come to that in a second. If you imagine the GHQ 30, the General Health Questionnaire 30, which is a measure of psychological distress, depression, essentially, it's got five dimensions: anxiety, incompetence, depression, difficulty coping, and social dysfunction. If you run a large sample of people on the GHQ 30 through mock and scaling, what you get is a set of items which actually cover all of those dimensions, but are ordered in a particular way. And I'm not going to go through this in painstaking detail, but essentially what you've got here is, I think you'll agree it's a fairly big sample, 6,000 people. Don't think there's any problem with the sample size here. It's got this score means that it shows invariant item ordering, that the items are scored at the level of the total group and at the individuals in the same order. And what you get is an increasing level of difficulty from generally being unable to face up to problems, it's a reversed item, so that's unable, and up to feeling life isn't worth living, which is probably an indicator of suicidal ideation. I'm not a mental health nurse, but I imagine that's not a very healthy state to be. And you can, if you look at the items, you know, not time at the moment, but they actually stack up fairly sensibly. It's getting more and more severe as you go up the scale. So mock and scaling has picked a set of items. We call it the GHQ9, but not officially, because Goldberg and his team would be very upset. But it's picked up nine items where the score on the total score is related specifically to the items that are being scored. So you know, it's given us more information about the GHQ30. Another example is the voice symptom scale, which is a measure of, some people have got a condition, I can't remember what it's called, I've forgotten, it's gone completely, I'm still jet lagged, where when they try to speak, they can't do what I'm doing just now. They could probably have a conversation, but publicly, is it globus hysteria? Globus hysteria, sorry, it's a condition whereby, essentially, there's nothing organic wrong with them at all, but they cannot speak publicly. And we ran a reasonably large sample, it's not huge, 480 people, on a questionnaire with a great many more items than here, and picked out a series of items. Again, you can see it's quite a sensible hierarchy. These are the most difficult items, and these are the least difficult. The least difficult item there is your voice hoarse. Oh yes, somebody who's got this condition will have a hoarse voice that anchors it at the bottom. Right up to the top, to a situation of shame and isolation, social isolation because of it. And if you look at the items, if you take the time to look at them, they all sort of, you know, they're all ordered sensibly in between. So it goes from a general sort of inability to speak through sort of embarrassment up to social isolation. Again, the first time that's been done with this scale, we picked out a series of items which may be useful. I mean, we need to do it on a bigger sample and repeat it, but may be useful in indicating how the score relates to the trait. And again, it shows it's a good scale. And the final example, before I just finish off on some of the back to some of the technical aspects, I've just photocopied, or at least I've screenshot a paper that's just been published in Psychological Assessment. I didn't actually realise it had been published, and I went and put the title into Medline and found out that it had actually been published recently. Investigating the autism spectrum quotient, which is a measure for people with broad spectrum autism. And very pleased to work with the team from Cambridge, including Simon Baron Cohen, who's the world expert on autism. And he developed a scale which has got something like five dimensions, measuring different aspects of autism. And Mary Stewart, with whom I've worked at Edinburgh before, the Perry Watt, which is in Edinburgh, wondered if there might be cumulative scales within this. So we ran a reasonably large sample, and what I've just done is screenshot the tables, so they're not going to be all that clear, but I'll just show you. We got three scales, I think, out of this, and we had two samples, one of university students who were not diagnosed or classified as having broad spectrum autism, and a group of students who were classified as having broad spectrum autism. And this is the group of university students without broad spectrum autism. And what you can see is there is actually a fairly, these are the factors that the items come from. So they come from different factors. So the structure, the factor structure isn't reproduced here. But what we're getting here is a hierarchy from, you know, new situations make me anxious, which is, you know, fair enough, most people feel that, up to, you know, I'd rather go to a library than a party, the way you would actually rather isolate yourself. So there's actually, you know, when you speak about broad spectrum autism, that everybody's on that particular, I'm not an expert on autism, but everybody's possibly on that somewhere, you can see that these people not diagnosed do show a kind of hierarchy of items. When you run the same data, the same questionnaire with different data from people who actually are diagnosed with broad spectrum autism, you get, again, a very obvious hierarchy. Some of the items are the same, some of them are slightly different, but you know, I find social situations easy as a reversed item. This is somebody with autism does not find social situations easy, up to, you know, I enjoy doing things spontaneously. In other words, they don't do things spontaneously at all, because that's another reversed item. It's complicated, you've got to keep the original wording. But again, there's quite a sensible hierarchy there between generally being unable to interact socially up to really having problems with it. So again, it's given us a bit more insight into the way that these autism, this particular autism questionnaire, which is probably one of the most popular ones, goes. Forget all this stuff, that's all the proving that it's a good scale or whatever. Okay, here's another one. This is from the same data. These are other items, all the ones from factor I, forgotten what I stands for. But essentially these are about using, I stands for imagination. That's what it's about, it's obvious when you read the items. This is about using imagination. The hierarchy is not quite so obvious or clear, although it is a moderately strong scale. But again, it's interesting that the Mockham scaling technique has picked out a set of items which are all to do with the same phenomenon. You know, these are all to do with, you know, with people with autism have difficulty being imaginative and creating situations in their head. And finally, again, these are invariantly ordered. The ordering of the items is quite hard to see in short scales, but again, it's picked out a set of items which are to do with fascination by numbers, patterns, and dates. We haven't, you know, as I say, the hierarchy isn't obvious to me. I'm not an expert on autism, but this interested my colleagues greatly, that these should be picked out as a factor and as a set of items on a Mockham scale. So that paper is just to say, it's just literally just coming out. So those are those are some examples of, I guess, clinical applications. Since 2010, there's been a huge amount of development in Mockham scaling, new graphical techniques, some of which I showed you, and they're being developed all the time. We can now calculate things like confidence intervals, despite the fact that these are non-parametric. We can calculate the confidence intervals to see if items, you know, they may look like that on a scale, but actually the confidence intervals may be overlapping. We can actually get some insight into sample size and how big the sample should be. And I have to warn you, if you're thinking of delving into Mockham scaling, I think the samples probably have to be a lot bigger than we've been using in some of these studies here. I think for Mockham scaling, we're talking about samples in the thousands rather than the hundreds very often, unless the scales are very strong. But we're getting an insight into that. And if you wanted to have a sort of non-technical and introduction to it, there's a paper which I first authored with van der Ark and Mayer, who are two Mockham experts. It's published in the Journal of Clinical Nursing. That's available if you want to read it. And if you want to look into it more, there's lots of papers coming out. Arguments about whether Mockham scaling is really IRT or a latent class analysis. I wouldn't lose any sleep over that one, but also warnings from certain scales. If they're too strong, we should be very careful in interpreting them. And here's a scale. You'll see in all of those, I'll just go through them again, in all of those, one item is lying miles away from the rest, and the problem is it exaggerates the strength of the scale. So you could never have predicted this before you had graphical techniques for looking at them. But what you should do with scales like that is be very careful. Remove that item and see if the rest of them are invariantly ordered. We can calculate standard errors and confidence intervals. We can calculate sample sizes as well, or we've got some insight into sample size. It's very much in its infancy. But approximately 800 seems to be the minimum adequacy for a sample size. So it's quite big. So conclusion, give me a few minutes to ask me questions, and for me to explain a crucial point which I forgot to explain, but I'll come back to that in a second. But is mock and scaling useful in clinical practice? Well, I think it is. I mean, obviously, I think it is because I use it and I use it a lot. But it's becoming much more sophisticated and much more useful and much more used. There are lots of papers out there using it on all sorts of areas. It's useful where relative rather than precise measurement is required. It's non-parametric. Okay, there's no assumption about the precise relationship between the item score and the latent trait, but we just know it goes like that. I forgot to explain that. For parametric item response theory, you assume a very nicely S-shaped distribution. So if you want to know that if somebody's better than they were yesterday or has more of this than somebody else, but you don't need to measure it precisely, then mock and scaling is ideal for that. And it brings added meaning to total scale scores. You'll see a lot of papers with RASH analysis being used where they don't make this point, but mock and scaling, is utterly dependent on that. And we need to do, for the future, we need to do empirical studies on sample size. We need to get big samples and chop them up and see what the effect is on mock and scaling. Nobody's done that yet. Actually, I have done it, but I've had 4 rejections of that paper, but it will get published eventually. And we need to do longitudinal studies. Nobody's yet done a longitudinal study, except me. I've just submitted a paper, which is for review at the moment. Sounds like I'm the expert in mock and scaling. I'm not. I work with excellent colleagues who helped me on this. But it's interesting when you try to break new ground in an area that the people in that ground already are very protective of it and say you don't need to do that. Okay, so that's my email address if anybody wants to amuse me or abuse me afterwards with questions. My ORCID number, but also my you've seen that already, my Twitter site. But also I've got a mock and scale Twitter site as well. Doesn't have many followers, but join and follow me by all means. So I've left a few minutes, I hope, for questions if anybody's got any. Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you.
Yes.
Which software can be used to analyze?
Say that again.
Data. A software.
Yes.
Can be used to analyze this data.
Yes. To analyze soft mock and scaling. Yes. Yeah. R. It's public domain software.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's available on the internet. If you Google the R project, my Scottish accent is difficult when you say that. The R project, you'll come across it, and within that there's a package for mock and scaling. And if you want to run it, email me and I'll send you the syntax. Or it's on my blog. I warn anybody that's thinking of using R, really, I'm not going to put you off. If I can learn, you can, and I'm 60 this year, and I only started a few years ago. But it really is, it's not easy. It's not menu driven or anything like that. It's typing in syntax and then getting it wrong and having to go back and do it.
Jeff, this technique can be used, of course, to develop new scales.
Yes.
And so you show us example that you extract some existing scale and then you can see some scaling, mock and scaling in the existing scales. So my question is that can you just take that mock and scaling and make it as a unique scale and then just use it, for example, the GHQ9?
We wouldn't be able to do that because of the copyright on the scale.
There's no copyright issue.
I think, that's one issue, is the copyright issue, but the conceptual issue, the sort of theoretical issue is, I think you've got to be careful of doing that. Mock and scales are good and they give you some insight into it, but people have put a lot of thought into developing the other items and you've got to be very aware of what's called construct underrepresentation. Some of these items actually do add useful information.
Yeah.
And I think the best thing to do is to take total scores from the scales as is, but also to look at this accumulative nature of the scale. And I think some scales are probably useful clinically as mock and scales. I think the Edfed scale is very useful. It's been shown time and again to be reproducible in different cultures and actually to mean something. But other scales, I think it's just giving you an insight into the way that the trait develops, basically, which you wouldn't get any other way. I mean, you get it with RASH, probably, but without item response theory, you just wouldn't see that development in the trait.
Hello.
I was listening, and oh, this is so interesting. And then I come up with a question, what about, you know, power sample analysis?
Yes.
How many is it required?
Okay.
And then you answer it.
Yeah, okay.
And it's quite a bit of a step back, you know, if you require at least 800.
Yeah,
so is there any work going on, you know, to overcome that?
Well, I mean, you can't do a formal power analysis, but the equivalent is to use the scalability coefficient is like an effect size. In the case of H, which I didn't go into this indeed, of an H scalability coefficient, which tells you how likely it is to scale. If that's large, then you need small samples, and if it's very small, you need big samples. Simple as that. Nobody quite knows where to draw the line. That's the problem. But if your scalability coefficient is about 0.35 or 0.4, which is about the minimum you need for a scale, then you can probably get off with sample sizes of 200 to 400. But very often, and this is for all the items, but if some of your item H values are very, very low, then you need bigger samples, simple as that. In my own paper, which hasn't yet been published, we had a database of 8,000 people on the Warwick Edinburgh Mental Wellbeing Scale, and what we did was sample with replacement. So we took 5%, 10% samples, and took five of them because we couldn't go on forever doing it, and looked at the effect on mock and scaling parameters. And in actual fact, around about 800 of the sample, they begin to get better, you know, so it's quite interesting. But we're having an awful lot of difficulty getting it published, because the problem is, I think, almost everybody involved in mock and scaling is involved in that paper. It's people outside the field who are reviewing it, so it's quite difficult, you know. But I think unlike factor analysis, you can't say this number of items and this number of people. It's got to do with the strength of the scale. Yeah.
I think the other thing that we found when we started doing research was that to ensuring that what you are looking at is what that
reminder. Yeah. You've got to eyeball it. You've got to run the basic on SPSS. Run the mean values to see if it's likely to come out. Yeah, I think you come to grief if you just run into to mock and scaling. And some things do not mock and scale. I mean, stress scales just don't. The HADS doesn't mock and scale for love nor money. I've had umpteen sets of HADS data from the UK, from Hong Kong, I think even one sample from Australia, and it just doesn't scale. It just doesn't do it. And I think it's because these are scales measuring things that happen to people on the whole, and they're random, whereas if you're measuring behaviours, which are intrinsic, they tend to be. But that's a pretty weak explanation, I have to say, but the HADS doesn't. And there's the new five-factor index, classic sort of personality inventory, the N dimension on that, beautiful, it just scales beautifully. There's another five-factor index, and I've forgotten the name of it, due to jet lag, and it's very similar to the Neo5, and we've got a huge sample of that, and it doesn't scale. You know, so now and again, you just get things that don't scale. So, hard to explain. So I think it's eyeballing the data is very, very good. There might be a hierarchy there, then we can do it. What would be really good to be able to do, and what we don't understand, how do you design good items? You know, it would be nice if we knew how to do that, and that's quite, we think we've designed a good item, it doesn't scale. You know.
Is it chicken and egg?
Yeah, I think it is. It's like, you know, good item scales, or ones that don't scale aren't good items. You know, that's right.
That's a great point.
It's difficult to tell from the wording of an item whether it's going to work well or not, mm-hmm. unless it's double barreled or vague. You know.
So, any more questions for Professor Roger Watson?
Well, you're welcome to have the slides, you're welcome to email me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So after I got all the slides from Roger, I will send it to you all just like I give a lecture. So I hope you enjoyed the lecture. Yeah, so I think Roger has explained a very complex concept in a very simple way for us to understand. Yeah, and I can see the value of this Morgan scaling, which helps us to understand more about the items within the scale or in one scale. And this may be a technique that we want to try in the future when we want to analyze our items or I hope you keep on publishing.
You want a highly paid consultant to help you do it.
You are our job professor.
Oh, right.
So I hope you keep on publishing new ideas so we can learn more about this technique. And hopefully we can apply in our clinical practice. I think that's the most important. Because all the study we conduct are clinical studies, you know. So we are translational researchers. So this type of organ scaling would be beneficial for us to understand behavior or some other concept we want to measure. And with this, I would like to end the lecture. So this one, in fact, is the last public lecture that is conducted by Professor Roger Watson during his research. But he still has two sort of lectures that he will give to us. One is tomorrow in the conference, in the Australian Nursing and Urology Conference. He will conduct a 2-hour workshop on writing. And then in our 25th anniversary celebration, so Professor Roger Watson will deliver a keynote lecture during our celebration. And he will talk about his sort of insight in nursing education, or nursing and midwifery education, to put it correct in Australia. Okay, so please join me to give a big hand to Professor Roger Watson.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for giving us three lectures.